Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, and our story this week is Formula for Conquest by James R. Adams.
I have a formula, the little man said loudly. I punched him ungently in the ribs and jerked my head toward the mangy crew whooping it up in the close confines of the ill-smelling Martian musk parlor.
Shh, not so loud, guy,
I whispered from the corner of my mouth. This bunch would slit your throat in a minute if they knew you had something on you that would bring a creditor to.
I don't know what your game is, but let's go in the back room where we can talk without starting someone's ears to burning.
I wrapped my arm around the guy's shoulders and steered him toward the back room, singing and laughing as though I had an overload of Mies Musk and was feeling a little bit happy. I didn't know what had brought the little fellow to me. I'd never seen him before, yet he seemed to know me and had made his way directly to the bar where I stood and addressed me by name. Anybody that knew that much about Todd Mulhane, soldier of fortune, needed looking into, and I was determined to give this mild-mannered shrimp of a man a thorough going over. I bolted the door behind us and seated myself at the table, always kept there for various games of chance. Mousy nervously assumed a seat and sat staring at me, his big milky blue eyes blinking nearsightedly, and a withered vein-covered hand tweaking incessantly at a bedraggled gray mustache.
"I'm Professor August Q. Twilkin," he essayed. "I have a formula."
"And I'm Todd Mulhane, as you seem to know, and I have a couple of great big ears open and waiting. What can I do for you, Twilkin?" Twilkin's face suddenly became grim, and the milkiness left his eyes a moment to disclose dancing hard lights of determination.
"Nothing for me, Mr. Mulhane," he said slowly. "This is for the world." "Yes, for three worlds."
I nodded patiently, thinking maybe I had a nut on my hands. "Of course, Twilkin, and just what is it we're going to do for these worlds?"
"We're going to save them from the coming interplanetary war," Twilkin said forcefully. "Here's the way things stack up. We know Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus have their armies poised for a quick thrust at the allied worlds, Mars, Earth, and Neptune. But so far they have hesitated, knowing both sides are pretty well matched in strength and fearing the assault might be drawn out in a long, destructive conflict that would gain them nothing. But they won't wait forever, however, and sooner or later they'll find a weakness in the allied world's armor and strike with all the force at their command. Mr. Mulhane, the allied worlds must be the ones to break this deadlock. We must be the ones to gain an edge and strength and force them to disarm or be destroyed by the ruthless machine of the brain behind their mad plot. But I forget. You know all of this, Mr. Mulhane."
"Todd's the name," I said absently. "Yes, I know all about Zan the Eighth's scheme to defeat the allied worlds."
"So what? There's nothing I can do about it. Naturally, being a Martian, I am anxious to see the allied worlds win, but I can't see..."
"You're a Martian?" Twilkin stared aghast.
But you look like an Earthian."
"I have many disguises," I smiled, "and many pseudonyms, among them being that of Todd Mulhane. A soldier of fortune such as I must resort to numerous devices to elude his enemies. Incidentally, how did you know who I was and where to find me?"
"I have contacts," Twilkin stammered, "but your disguise seems so realistic. I would swear you're an Earthian."
"I put my entire being into a part. I would long since be dead if I were unconvincing in my characterizations. But we digress, Twilkin. Come to the point."
"The point is this," Twilkin recovered from his astonishment.
If we had the support of one of the lesser planets, such as Venus, oh, we could easily overthrow Zan's regime and bring a lasting peace to the system. But at the time, the inhabitants of Venus are in a crude stage of evolution and are too stupid to be of much help. They have expressed their willingness to help, but their ignorance might well be a weight on our progress and turn the tide against us. I shifted uneasily in my chair and glanced at the door. But supposing evolution could be speeded up on Venus, Twilkin continued. Supposing the inhabitants could be developed as much in 2 months as would ordinarily take 1,000 years, they would soon emerge to a state of intelligence as to be of immense value and aid to our cause. And I have something that will do this very thing, Todd. I leaped from my chair and wrenched the door open, just about scaring Professor Twilkin out of a year's growth. A short, fat Jovian fell into the room and lay grinning up from the floor. His pink, shaggy-browed eyes searched our faces briefly, then he arose, bowing deeply.
"Gentlemen," he intoned, "I hope I am not intruding. I was leaning wearily against this door, half asleep, and then I suddenly find myself lying there on the floor."
He gestured at the bare planks and laughed. It sounded like a snake hissing.
"Most clumsy of me."
The Jovian's inability to pronounce the letter T made his speech sound like that of a Venusian gunman. I wondered how much he had overheard. The Jovian bowed again, brushing dust from his gleaming spun metal tunic.
"I trust I have not inconvenienced you, gentlemen. I must be more careful in the future. I have a nasty habit of falling asleep at other people's doors. Now, if you will excuse me..."
The Jovian slid through the door and lost himself in the hubbub beyond. I had a hunch we were going to have trouble from him. People just didn't go around falling asleep against strange doors without a purpose. Twilkin had sat all this time, his milky eyes looking about for a hole to crawl into, and his hand clutched his breast as though about to have a heart attack. "Is that your formula?" I indicated his tunic pocket.
"Yes, it must never fall into the hands of the Jovians, Todd. Oh, they could make fearful use of it. We must carry out my plan quickly, or that son of a..."
Twilkin clapped a hand over his mouth to stifle the strong words he had been about to utter.
"That mad devil will warn his consorts, and they'll be after us like hounds. In all fairness, Todd, you must know the Allied Worlds Council is not endorsing my venture. The diplomatic relations between worlds are stretched to the breaking point, and if the Jovian government thought the Council was supporting such a plan, they might strike immediately with devastating results to the morale of our people, for there are some who think we can't possibly stand against such an efficient organization as Zan's. That's why I need you. You have a fast ship. You have courage and brains to carry out my course of action. If I should fall by the wayside, will you help me?"
I grinned and hitched up my pants, Earth fashion.
"When do we start?"
We were well out in the void, thundering toward Venus, when Twilkin pointed excitedly at a small speck on the telescreen.
"That's a ship, Todd!" he yelled. "That blasted Jovian's following us!"
I poured more power to my craft and slammed down frantically on the meteor shield stud, but it was too late. A great blast rocked the ship, and girders groaned their protest as they buckled under the terrific pressure. A piece of flying metal smacked Twilkin on the head, and he sank to the floor out cold. I ran to the navigation room locker and snatched out a couple of spacesuits. I tugged and stuffed Twilkin into one and barely made it into my own when the air began to hiss out through the torn plates. We were caught up in the vacuum and whisked out into the dark, cold vastness to float about like 2 corks in a mill pond. The Jovian ship, for such it proved to be, rushed in quickly and fastened a grappling beam on our helpless figures. In less than a minute, we were inside the cruiser and facing the leering Jovian of the Musk Parlor incident.
"I am most pleased in this opportunity to renew our acquaintance," he smirked. "No doubt you know what I am after. I shall waste no time in playing cat and mouse. Give me the formula, and there shall be no trouble."
Twilkin came to long enough to shout, "You shan't have it!"
"But I will," the Jovian assured him. "I have but to search you. I am certain we shall find the formula on your person. Will you surrender it voluntarily, or must we use force?"
"Give it to him, Augie," I said. "We're cold turkey."
"Mr. Beldade is quite correct," the Jovian agreed. "You have no alternative but to relinquish your secret."
Twilkin groaned despairingly and removed his bulger. He dug in his pocket and brought out the formula, somewhat the worse for wear. The Jovian snatched it eagerly and beamed toothily at us, his thin pointed tongue darting like a snake over his bloated lips.
"Dink you, Mr. Twilkin. Never fear, I shall make good use of your formula. Would you care to know how I intend to defeat the allied worlds with it?"
We remained silent.
"Very well, I shall tell you. Just as you have a potential ally in Venus, the inhabitants of Pluto are likewise sympathetic to our cause. As you know, they long ago reached and passed the point of greatest intelligence and are slowly reverting to the savage stage from which they evolved. I propose to halt this retrogression with the assistance of Mr. Dwilkin's formula and restore them to their former greatness. They will be thankful to us Jovians, yes, and they will be happy to assist us in our conquest of the allied worlds."
You fiend!" Augie spluttered ineffectually. "You're going to use my formula to swing the balance of power in your favor?"
"That's right," the Jovian bowed. "Is not just the very same thing you intended to do for your own worlds during the bout is fair play I once heard on Earth?"
"But we weren't planning to destroy you and your crummy bunch with it," Augie shouted, incensed at the Jovian's condescending air. "We were only going to use it to force your armies to disarm and to remove your cutthroat clique from power."
"No doubt," the Jovian waved a plump, bejeweled hand, "and that must never be. Zed the Third has utmost confidence in my ability as chief of the Jovian secret police. And if I fail, he would surely kill me before retiring into exile. I remember his exact words. Mon Pordo, if you betray the trust placed in you, there can be nothing but dead as a reward." "You can readily appreciate my predicament, gentlemen. I must give victory to my government, or perish as a result. Naturally, when I overheard your conversation at the Musk Parlor, I realized that here was a means to an end."
"You're a sly devil, Mon Pardo," I said harshly.
"Thank you, Mr. Belaine. That is a necessary evil of my profession. The ship has set the course for Jupiter, and there you will be held prisoners pending the outcome of our experiments with Dwilkin's formula."
"And then you'll kill us," Augie said hotly.
"Perhaps that is for me to decide. You certainly have no choice in the matter. And now," Pordo indicated three hulking Jovian brutes waiting to pounce on us, "these gentlemen will escort you to your cells. It is regrettable I cannot allow you the run of the ship, but the opportunities thus offered might prove too tempting to resist. I advise you to go quietly, gentlemen."
We went quietly. We were placed in adjoining cells, and Twilkin spent his rage in rattling the bars and cursing Mon Pordo for a bloody, ill-spawned, war-mongering idiot. The Jovians paid no attention, however, and Augie soon simmered down to a slow boil, pacing his cage like a trapped animal. We got to talking, and Augie wanted to know all about me and why I had chosen such a career, and did I have any immediate plans for escape? At first, I was reluctant to talk about my life history as a freebooter of space, but Augie was persistent, and I soon broke down. I hardly knew how to start, but the words came easy once I got going. Augie listened attentively, interjecting questions here and there. "I am a Martian," I began, "but I was reared and educated on Earth, and consequently, I think, act and talk much as an Earthian. I suppose that's the main reason I mostly adopt the role of Todd Mulhane when hiring out my services. My real name doesn't matter, it wouldn't mean anything to you. As to why I became a soldier of fortune, perhaps it's because of an insatiable appetite for adventure I possess, or maybe because I was left an orphan at an early age and just naturally drifted into it. Well, that doesn't matter either. I've put a lot of space behind my tubes in my brief span of years and seen a lot of things that would make your blood run cold, things I've never talked of before. Nor will I tell of them now, so you can sketch in the details yourself if you care to. I've told all that's worth listening to." We had been conversing in low whispers, and Augie glanced up and down the corridor to make sure no guards were present before voicing his most imperative query. "Most interesting," he approved, "but surely you have a method of escape plan. We can't just sit here and let these devils go through with their mad deed." I motioned for silence, and Augie subsided, watching my antics with great interest. I placed my hand between two bars and pulled gently, with an even pressure. My companion stared bug-eyed as the hand came loose, exposing a pink tentacle ending in five wire-thin appendages. Augie gasped, suddenly remembering his Martian anatomy. "Of course!" he breathed jubilantly. "I'd forgotten. If Porto had realized you were a Martian, he would never have placed you in an uninsulated cell." I laughed. "We're not going to escape yet, though," I said softly. "It would do no good. Porto would merely recapture us and lock us away in the insulated cargo hold. We wouldn't have a chance then." "Oh, what do you plan to do then?" Augie asked perplexedly. "We'll let them think we're helpless," I explained. "They'll go ahead with their scheme, and at the crucial moment, we'll step in and queer the works." I replaced the false hand. "How?" Augie wanted to know. "That," I said, "remains to be seen." The pilot brought the cruiser in for a perfect landing, and the unceasing throb of the rocket sputtered, died, and gave way to a loud silence. Mon Porto came down the passageway, flanked on each side by a stony-faced guard. His cruel lips parted in a wide grin as he unlocked our cells and motioned us out. "We have arrived, gentlemen," he hissed. "I am pleased to note you have made no effort to escape. We shall proceed immediately to the governmental palace, where you will be interned in the underground prison block. You will accompany these men who will lead you to your quarters." The muscle man hustled us from the ship and into a waiting surface car. I had refitted the false hand, fusing the ends of the plastic together with a quick jolt of electricity. The stupid guards didn't expect anything as we roared from Jove City Spaceport, headed for the luxurious palace which housed the high officials of Jovian government. I could have burnt them to a crisp where they sat, but Twilkin was to one side of me, and he would be the first to get it. I decided other avenues of action would present themselves in due time, so I relaxed against the cushions and stared casually out the window, mentally mapping the route we were following to use as reference in our coming escape. Twilkin sat dejectedly, his milky eyes playing tag with a small insect beating frantically against the window. I felt a strange kinship for this mild little man. He was so darn concerned over our plight, so terribly anxious to regain the formula he had labored long and hard to perfect. I wasn't so worried about our present unfavorable circumstances as he, having built up an immunity to such misfortunes in my past escapades. Nevertheless, my brain was working overtime, seeking a way to circumvent the Jovian plot once we had escaped. We break to a halt in the palace courtyard, and the two ugly Jovians prodded us toward a massive solid steel door. The damp moss-covered tunnel through which we passed ran deep under the palace, and row after row of tiny unlighted cells lined each side. Many of them were occupied, and I didn't care to look twice at the wild-eyed, disease-racked bodies of Nan's victims. There was a hopeless look on those hollow-cheeked faces, a blank, why-go-on-fighting stare in the eyes of the more sane, the ones who hadn't been there very long yet. The cells were wet and filth-littered, and the suffocating stench of the place was so dense you could almost see it. We were more fortunate in the matter of living conditions. The cell in which we were placed was large, tolerably dry, and was supplied with a couple of candles for illumination. Still, the unrelenting smell and the tortured moans of the prisoners was enough to drive a man mad.
"Although wants to keep you alive a while," one of the guards explained, referring to the clean cell, "if this formula doesn't show results, it's going to be too bad for you fellows. Porto don't like to be dampered with, so if all this is just a trick, look out."
The Jovian slammed the door, and the pair went off down the tunnel, echoes of their laughter rolling back to bounce gleefully through the cells, plucking one more anguished groan from the lips of the half-dead men within. The old-fashioned wax candles were relics of a long-gone day and age, manufactured solely for ornamentation. But some scientist had whiled away a few idle hours by adding a couple of new features. Augie removed the cap from the wick of one, and it burst into a brilliant, unflickering flame. Even it was far superior to the crude electric lighting of the ancients. "What now?" Augie asked. "We wait," I said. "This cell isn't too uncomfortable, and we can bide our time here, play the game Porto's way, and lull him into a sense of invulnerability. Things may come to a head sooner than you think, and you can bet we'll be in there fighting at the end." Augie's eyes flamed and his face screwed into a mask of hate. "I despise that tyrant Porto," he breathed soulfully. "Damn him, if I may use such a vulgar term." I glanced about the cell and located a musty, well-worn cot. It was the only one the room contained, so it was the floor for one of us. Night must be spreading its black cloak across the world outside, and we were both dead tired. "We'll flip a coin for the bed," I said, "then we'll alternate its use for as many nights as we're here." Augie chose heads and flipped the coin. It came up tails. "Damn," he reiterated. "Seems my luck has flown the coop for good." He crossed the room and snapped the cap down over the candle wick. Darkness rushed in, probing inky fingers under the cot and in crevices, eager to strangle any loitering mote of its fleeing enemy. Porto visited us the next day, anxious to let us know how he was progressing. He bowed his silly, condescending bow.
"I trust you have slept well, gentlemen. I am indeed sorry there are no better quarters available, but the choice rooms of the palace are quite well filled with the visiting diplomats of our allies. Incidentally, the Plutonians have also arrived for the experiment."
"You mean you're going to conduct the experiment right here on Jupiter?"
Augie exclaimed wide-eyed.
"That is precisely what I mean," the Jovian bit out. "Do you object?"
Augie was too confused to offer a reply. He just stood staring at Porto, tiny beads of sweat popping out on his forehead.
"You will ask why," Porto divined. and I can see no danger in dulling you. We have got to test the formula first on a selected few individuals from Pluto. Accordingly, the 25 most highly advanced intellects of Pluto have been brought here to the palace and will undergo the speeded-up evolution process. In this way, we may make advanced contact with the enlightened Plutonians before evolving the masses and make a pact with them, pledging their planet's aid in our project. Then the millions of others will receive the treatment, and we will be ready to act. We are not too stupid to realize the evolved creatures might possess animosity toward our purpose. Thus, in our first experiment, we are evolving no more than can be easily eliminated should they prove hostile. The formula is even now being prepared and will be applied immediately. According to Mr. Dwelkin's data, the process should be complete in 2 months at the most. It is pleasant to contemplate, isn't it, gentlemen?
It will never work,
Augie shrieked. Your plan is utterly mad.
It better work, Porto said significantly. I'm afraid I shall be forced to administer drastic punishment to those who have thus wasted my dime. Good day, gentlemen.
We watched the receding figures through the bars. And when Porto was out of sight, Augie said through grim lips, I don't like it, Todd. He's hitting into something he can't handle. The fifth day of our confinement, Augie did something that almost put the fat in the fire. A guard brought our food and water each day and would dawdle a while in the cell, heaping salt on our wounds by informing us of how well the experiment was going forward. This day, he was exceptionally boastful, and Augie was feeling particularly testy about the whole thing. The Jovian had explained in much detail how you could actually see the Plutonians evolving as the formula took effect. His eyes bugged in awe as he told how the skin and flesh stretched and twisted on the skeletons, forming itself into new substance. As he turned to leave, smug in the knowledge he had paved the way for a sleepless night, Augie jumped from the cot and hissed after him.
Miss Mouti!
The guard whirled, eyes blazing. The Jovians were extremely sensitive about their vocal defect that made forming the letter T physically impossible. Augie's hot expletive was the equivalent of telling Porto's underling he was too dumb to pronounce the sound. The enraged dupe leaped at Augie, snarling fiercely. The two went down in a tangle, flying arms and legs, the Jovian pouring sledgehammer blows into Augie's midriff, blows that were meant to kill. He wore no gun or he would have used it. The Jovians were giving us no opportunity at escape. I jumped into the fray, knowing if I didn't intercede in Augie's behalf, the guard would maul him into a bloody pulp. The Jovian turned on me and closed in, fists flailing and teeth gritting in fury at my interruption. I sidestepped his wild body punch and heard bone crunch as I caught his chin on a well-timed uppercut. The guard screamed, blood dripping from his torn lips, and Augie came in triumphantly from behind, raining mincy bird-like blows on his head. It didn't last long. The other guards, attracted by the clamorous uproar, came on the run and quickly subdued us with clubbed flame pistols. Our badly beaten opponent was dragged from the room, uttering garbled, vengeful threats, and we were left to lick our wounds. You shouldn't have done that, I mildly reproached Augie. I was mad, he thrust out a stubborn chin. They are stirring up a hornet's nest, Todd, and I won't be responsible for what happens. My formula was meant to be used on the native worlds of the subjects.
And there's no telling what kind of monstrosities they may evolve by not following the natural laws embodied in it. The resultant organisms may be intelligent, yes, but...
Augie broke off, tenderly fingering a swollen eye and munching thoughtfully on his lower lip.
He was sure down in the dumps all right, and I couldn't blame him. We were in a hell of a mess, putting it mildly. 3 worlds to save, and we couldn't even save ourselves.
We spent 2 full months in the dungeon. I fretted away the last 30 nights on the floor since contact with the cold stone had goaded Augie's rheumatism into full flare. News leaked in now and then, and on the 62nd day, our guard disclosed the experiment had been completed, and the high officials of Jupiter and its cohorts would meet that very day with the evolved Plutonians in the Grand Assembly Hall of the Palace to form a pact that would seal the fate of the allied worlds.
"Now is the time, Augie,"
I whispered excitedly. Augie was electrified into action. He backed off in a corner and pulled the cot down over him. There would be tremendous heat. I placed one hand under a foot and heaved up. The false hand remained on the floor, leaving my prehensile tentacle free to act. I strode to the door and glanced up and down the tunnel. No guards were present. They were probably outside discussing the conference, which was now in progress. I twined my fingers around a thick steel bar and gave it all the juice I had. The metal glowed red hot, slowly fading into an incandescent white. The stuff began to melt, flowing out into the tunnel and forming bubbling puddles at my feet. The door didn't last long. All that was left was the cooling pools of metal and a gaping frame that yawned invitingly. The way was clear. "Willing to take a chance?" I asked. Augie gulped and nodded weakly. I boosted him to my back and made a sudden dash through the hissing liquid steel, taking care not to slip. I wasn't afraid for myself. I'm non-conductive to heat. But Augie, perched precariously on my back, would certainly be engulfed and devoured by the stuff if I should fall. Then we went through the molten hell, making our way cautiously down the passageway. Pitiful moans assailed our ears. Frenzied pleas for us to release the sufferers inside welled forth from the dark cells, but I was adamant. "Time enough for that later, if we're successful," I said to Augie. "These half-dead creatures would only be in our way in the coming fight." We reached the outer door, and I pulled tentatively on the handle. It was unlocked. Apparently the guards thought the thick cell doors were enough protection against escape, and hadn't bothered to fasten this one. Anyway, they would return soon.
"You wait here," I whispered to Augie. "They're probably outside the door and would raise a hell of a noise if we came rushing out fighting. I may be forced to use a little persuasion on them."
I opened the door and stepped casually outside. The guards were huddled in a circle, not 10 feet from me, absorbed in an abstract debate on what would arise from the palace conference. One of them spotted me and let out a squeal.
"Look," he stammered, "one of the prisoners is loose."
They marshaled their forces and advanced on me slowly, quietly, seeing no reason to summon aid. There were 5 of them. I was but one. They made a concerted rush and clamped eager hands on my arms. Mon Porto and Zan would reward them liberally for thwarting such an ill-planned coup. It was so easy, too. I placed my exposed tentacle on the shoulder of one and let go with a few thousand volts. The Jovians were packed together tightly, and the electric charge dispatched them with grim ease. There was nothing left but a sickening mass of blackened, cooked flesh. Augie poked his head through the door and gagged wretchedly at the carnal sight. "It was necessary," I said. We stuffed the charred bodies inside the tunnel door and fled swiftly across the courtyard to the palace proper, where I pointed to a high window. Vines ran rampant on the wall. It would be an easy matter to climb up them to the window. We started up, gaining footing in small cracks between stones and going hand over hand toward the opening. Augie looked down once and turned a pale green. From then on, he kept his eyes fastened to our objective. I reached the window first and held out a hand to Augie. I pulled him through, and we stood looking about. We were on a huge balcony, overlooking the brilliantly lighted Grand Assembly Hall. The most eminent political figures of three planets were there below us. Here was Taj Morcus and Klex the Second of Saturn. There was Wen Dorn and the intellectual, if perverted scientist, Haljan from Uranus. The wily Mon Porto was all about the hall like a fretful hen, bowing and shaking hands and directing the villainous delegates to seats at the council table. At the head of the table sat Zan the Eighth himself, adorned from head to foot with rare exotic jewels, watching the redundant proceedings from Bord's seemingly sleepy eyes. There were many, many more, but those six were the main cogs of the machine. I counted exactly 100 figures seated around the table, and some of them were strange beings indeed. I knew immediately that these were the evolved Plutonians. There were 25 of them, ranged along one side of the immense table, fidgeting uncomfortably under the concentrated attention of their hosts. There was something odd about those creatures, although I couldn't say just what. Certainly their color was strange, a sick yellowish white. But that wasn't what bothered me. I could tell by their actions they were rational, thinking beings. It was something about their flesh that had me going. Augie solved the problem with his next words. "My lord," he whispered loudly, "those creatures are composed almost entirely of an impure form of calcium carbonate. I thought something like this would happen. Away from the native world, the Plutonian process of evolution was torn between its natural tendencies and the contradictory characteristics of its new environment. This is the result." It was then I knew what we must do. We went over the plan hurriedly, yet making sure there were no flaws. Down below, Mon Porto was beginning a speech. He stood at the table importantly, white teeth flashing against the purple background of his corpulent lips.
"Gentlemen,"
he began blandly, as if that was the only form of address he knew,
"I have the unequaled honor of presenting to you a most marvelous revelation. I have the privilege of making known to you that which has been kept secret from your eyes, that which we have often hinted at in past 2 months, but have not yet divulged. Once I have made this great disclosure, you will realize victory is within our grasp, just as our enemies will realize further resistance is entirely futile and will abandon their idealistic cause.
He rambled on like that for half an hour, finally getting around to introducing the Plutonians. Things moved more swiftly then. The Plutonians were just the least bit reluctant to form an alliance, and the experienced diplomats argued, pleaded, thrust, and parried, and generally browbeat them into a decision. The confident delegates finally withdrew to other parts of the palace to give the beleaguered Plutonians a chance to think it over in private. This was what I had been counting on, and we took quick advantage of the situation. Augie scurried back through the window and clung to the vines outside to be a safe distance away from what was to come. An hour, the diplomats had said, we would make good use of those 60 minutes. I leaped to the balcony rail and plummeted down in the center of the hall. The Plutonians didn't have time to get out so much as a peep. I had divested myself of both false arms, and even in midair, I released a killing charge of electricity that left the duped creatures slumped in their chairs, lifeless hulks. If the armed Mon Pordo had been there, things would probably have been different. The Jovians were quick-eyed and quick-acting, and he would have blasted me to pieces with his automatic the minute I appeared on the balcony rail. That's why I couldn't risk it before. I didn't want Augie facing the devils alone. I spent quite a little time in the hall, standing in the center of the table and sending out wave after wave of electricity over the dead Plutonians, doing things to their bodies. Finally satisfied I had accomplished my purpose, I arranged the beings in lifelike poses along the table and moved silently to a spot beneath the balcony rail. Augie had succeeded in tearing one of the tough vines loose from the palace wall, and now he lowered it to me, keeping a wary eye on the hall door. Going quickly up the thin fiber strand, I stepped jubilantly over the rail and found myself looking directly into the venom-filled eyes of Mon Pordo. He was standing in back of little Augie, a little to one side, so the deadly automatic held unwaveringly in his hand could cover us both. The frozen surprise on my face caused Augie to turn and stare sickly. All the heart seemed to go out of him at that moment. His shoulders slumped wearily, and the hard lines of determination in his face dissolved into a black pool of despair beneath the caustic solvent of a big, unashamed tear. We were beaten. For once Pordo was so infuriated he forgot all about bowing. His eyes smoldered like blobs of hot grease about to burst into flame. Frenzied, unholy hate seemed to ooze from every pore. Even so, he spoke quietly.
"I need a plan, gentlemen, but it has failed, just as all plots against Zan the Third will fail. True, you have given us temporary setback by killing the Plutonians, but we still have the formula, and there are others who, though not as intelligent, will well serve our purpose. It is too bad I decided to visit you during Debesis, isn't it? Otherwise your rash act may have succeeded. When I found you gone and your guards dead, I knew instantly what you were up to, and came here as soon as the logical point for you to strike from. I'm sorry, gentlemen, but you are too dangerous to be allowed to live, so I must eliminate you."
Pordo raised the gun and his finger tightened on the firing stud. This was it. I couldn't blast Pordo with an electric shock without killing Augie, too. "Goodbye, Todd Mulhane. You've had a short but interesting life." I steeled myself for the atomic capsule that would soon rip through my body. Augie acted almost impulsively. He still held the fibrous vine in his hand and had noted slyly one of Pordo's feet enmeshed in the extending end. He lunged suddenly backward, and Pordo came down hard on the balcony floor. Instantly we were on him, clawing, punching, making a desperate bid for the automatic. Pordo tried to scream, and Augie planted a solid kick in his belly. The Jovian suddenly decided he didn't want to scream, maybe because there wasn't any air left in him to yell with. I whipped a tentacle about the fat throat and began tightening my muscles ruthlessly. Pordo's eyes bugged hideously, and the wind whistled through his teeth in a vain effort to enter his lungs. Sure, we were 2-on-1, but fair play didn't enter the picture. We were fighting to save 3 worlds, and Zan and his henchmen had used the same tactics in their blood-drenched rise to power. This was a case of
"Darned about his fair play," as Pordo would say.
Right now, he wasn't saying anything. The fat body had gone limp in my grasp, and Pordo's evil soul was probably this minute bowing at the gates of hell and saying, "Gentlemen,
they'll be returning any minute," Augie panted anxiously. "We've got to work fast."
I handed him a small chunk of stuff I'd gouged from the body of a dead Plutonian and retired to my place at the balcony rail. Augie took the stuff gingerly and placed it on the flat, upturned butt of Pordo's automatic. He crossed the slanting balcony to a point where the ceiling almost met the floor and waited there breathlessly. A network of pipes ran across that ceiling, pipes that contained water. This part of the palace was much the same as it had been many years ago when the first Jovian dictator had met with his underlings here in the assembly hall and formed the policies of government that had laid the groundwork for eventual system domination. The Jovians entertained a sentimental attachment to this outmoded room and wouldn't think of modernizing it, except for inconsequential details such as lighting. Even the ancient automatic sprinkler system remained. Originally used to combat fire, it was now nothing but an ornament, a relic of bygone days. The Jovians didn't need it now. Scattered about the room were dozens of the recently invented kellosirene capsules, one of which could extinguish the most persistent of flames. But I was staking everything on the hope the sprinkler was still connected to a water pump. The diplomats were re-entering the room. They moved forward confidently, unrealizing of the fact the Plutonians were dead. Zan led the procession, his gigantic belly bouncing up and down in rhythm to his pompous steps. "Now!" I waved my hand frantically at Augie. He snapped to sudden life. A stream of saliva squirted from his lips and impaled the stuff on the gun butt. It literally exploded into flames. Fingers of fire danced around the gun butt, questing hungrily for something to absorb. Augie supplied that something. He moved the gun up under a rusty sprinkler pipe and held it there. Luckily, he had had the foresight to empty the gun's atomic capsules and wrap a torn piece of cloth about his hand. The assembly hall was big and the men below were walking slowly. Augie's torch had ample time to heat the pipes before the group reached the table. Zan was getting suspicious. The unmoving forms of the Plutonians had him puzzled. They ought to at least have the courtesy to rise from their chairs and acknowledge his august presence. At that moment, one of the dead beings tumbled from his seat, breaking into a million pieces as he hit the floor. Zan yelped alarmedly and rushed forward. Just as the sprinkler pipes opened up and gushed forth a thick sheet of water, drenching the whole assemblage. Things began to happen then. A tremendous whoosh shook the room and a canopy of flame flashed out from the table. In a trice, the hall was a blazing holocaust. Scream after scream tore from the throats of the victims as the roaring inferno gulped them in and fiery teeth gnawed the flesh from their bones. There wasn't a chance of one of them reaching a kellosirene capsule. We raced to the window and tumbled down the vines. I had the location of the spaceport well fixed in my mind, although it didn't matter much now if we were captured. The plot had been foiled. "We have the Plutonians to thank for our success," Augie yelled, pounding across the courtyard. He was right. Calcium carbonate had been almost the sole constituent of the Plutonians. There were other elements, yes, but in a far less degree. Using electricity for heat, I had simply converted that impure carbonate into a crude form of calcium oxide. It was crumbly stuff, but it had stuck together long enough to deceive the conspirators into thinking everything was shipshape in the assembly hall. When those sprinkler pipes let go with their load of water, well, any high school boy can tell you what happened. "What about those devils in the dungeon, Todd?" Augie had to shout to make himself heard above the turmoil. Guards were running for the palace, intent on saving their ruler. Screaming court ladies were dropping from windows enveloped in clouds of dense black smoke. I knew the kellosirene capsules had long since burst and put out the flames, but not before they had done their grisly job. "They'll be released when the Jovians find their government has collapsed about them," I flung back. "We've got to get away from here before these people come out of their daze." That sounds cowardly, but to me it was prudence. We found a surface car and sped for the Jove City spaceport. It was deserted. Everybody had been drawn to the palace by the frantic emergency calls of the Jovian secret police. We scrambled into a small private cruiser and soon were far out in space, making for Earth. "In a way, I'm glad the formula was lost," Augie said reflectively. "I can't reconstruct it from memory, you know, too complicated. I don't think I would anyway, seeing what havoc it can cause." I nodded, setting the automatic control and relaxing in the bucket seat. Todd Mulhane had pulled through one more scrape. "Two," Augie continued, "there would be no need of it now. Our enemies will be practically helpless now their leaders are dead, and we can easily force them to capitulate. The Jovians and their allies should welcome a democratic government after so many years of tyranny. Incidentally, Todd, where do you go from here?" I grinned at Augie and lit a tobacco tube. "I haven't any plans, Augie, but you can bet I'll not sit home knitting."
There are universes unknown and unexplored, planets and strange life forms waiting to be discovered, the mysteries of time and space, a riddle yet to be solved. Join me next week for another exciting adventure on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. ¶¶